Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I found that patience is a good practice here.
The much-anticipated Senate hearing on domestic surveillance got off to a very rocky start today after Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter, a Republican, decided that the sole witness, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, did not need to be sworn in, a move which sparked protest from Democrats concerned that Gonzalez may have previously lied about the program under oath. Senator Specter cautioned that the president does not have a blank check to bypass the current law that prohibits spying without warrants on Americans. Ranking Democrat Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy had this to say to Gonzalez.
I have many questions for you. But first, let me give you a message, Mr. Attorney General, to you, to the president, and to the administration. This is a message that should be unanimous from every single member of Congress, no matter what their party or their ideology. Under our Constitution, Congress is the co-equal branch of government, and we make the laws. If you believe you need new laws, then come and tell us. If Congress agrees, we'll amend the law. If you do not even attempt to persuade Congress to amend the law, then you're required to follow the law as it's written.
But Attorney General Gonzalez defended what the administration calls the terrorist surveillance program.
Mr. Chairman, the terrorist surveillance program is necessary, it is lawful, and it respects the civil liberties we all cherish. It is well within the mainstream of what courts and prior presidents have authorized. It is subject to careful constraints, and congressional leaders have been briefed on the details of its operation. To end the program now would be to afford our enemy dangerous and potentially deadly new room for operation within our own borders.
Joining us on the line from Washington is Gail Chaddick. She's covering the hearings for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, let's get to Gonzalez first. There is concern in Washington that he may have lied about this program in his confirmation hearings for Attorney General in 2005. Were you surprised that Arlen Specter, a Republican senator, said Gonzalez didn't have to be sworn in?
That was a tremendous surprise. Senator Specter has been very even-handed in how he's dealt with Democratic concerns up to this point, and he did have Mr. Gonzalez sworn in the two previous times he spoke before the committee. So for many, it raised the question, why the change? And Senator Specter uncharacteristically refused to answer it directly. He said, I've examined a lot of facts, and I'm the chairman and you're not, is basically his response. So it really did get the hearings off to a unusually rocky start.
Well, we're going to say the Democrats are angry, but what has been the tone of the hearing? Has it been bipartisan questioning? What's been the tone?
Well, it's interesting because on the surface it is quite partisan. There's a lot of flinging back and forth, but just below the surface there's a lot of agreement among members as to issues that they want resolved. For example, both Senator Specter and Senator Kennedy, although less emphatically than Senator Kennedy, Senator Specter asked the question, are you using material from these warrantless wiretaps to get material for wiretaps you do apply for? And if so, is that a problem? Senator Kennedy, in a more dramatic way, said that by going it alone, the administration is undermining our security. They're putting at risk both NSA officials involved in the program, some of the court cases that may come against members of al-Qaeda, the most dangerous and cruel, he said, and even the phone company. So you have on both sides of the aisle the Attorney General being pressed on whether or not he is using what could be judicially tainted material in a way that could come back and undermine further prosecutions. And he didn't really respond to that question, and Senator Specter ended his pressing on that point by just saying, I would urge you to rethink your answer. So it's not as strong as what Kennedy said, but actually it's the same point.
By the way, you mentioned the phone companies. Looking ahead, do you think the CEOs of some of the big phone companies that we understand now have been cooperating with the government in this spy program will be called?
I'm not sure how far this is going to go, but the Judiciary Committee is going to look at least at two more sessions on this. including possibly calling former Attorney General Ashcroft. I think the Democrats would insist on the phone company being called, and I think it's likely we'd see them.
Well, and today Gonzalez once again said that the president had the constitutional and statutory authority to authorize domestic spying. He was asked by Senator Leahy if he knew if the program allowed for such things as a secret opening of the U.S. mail. What did Gonzalez say to that?
Well, he didn't respond directly. He kind of retreated back into not wanting to give too much information about this program, and Senator Leahy, became very agitated at that point that this was not the kind of answer he was expecting. Senator Biden pressed even further. Can you assure us that no one has been caught up in these wiretaps that shouldn't have been? And again, the Attorney General could not give a straight answer to that question. So I think you're going to see for the whole rest of the day more pressing on both of those points. What are the assurances that ordinary Americans are not being included? It's not enough to just assert they're not. You have to show us that that's not the case.
Gail Chadha, a congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, at today's Senate hearings into the president's warrantless domestic spy program. Gail, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
The National Security Agency conducts worldwide surveillance, fax, phones, satellite communication.
Why are they after me?
I don't know, and I don't want to know. Here they come.
The 1999 film The Enemy of the People starred Will Smith as a bewildered American tracked by the NSA, the National Security Agency, Gene Hackman, the rogue agent, trying to help him. The film apparently struck fear in the heart of Michael Hayden, then head of the real-life NSA, and for the first time as a result, this highly secretive agency went on a PR campaign to convince Americans it would never spy on them without a warrant, as was done in the movie. Well, that was then. This is now, with 9/11 falling in between. To give us more context about the history of wiretapping by the NSA, we turn to Phil Hyman. He was Deputy U.S. Attorney General from 1993 to 94 during the Clinton administration. He was also a former associate prosecutor to the Watergate Special Force. He now teaches at Harvard Law School. And Phil, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And I'm sure you remember at the time of this film, which I happened to see the other day, and it's chilling in watching it in current day context. But even back then, NSA Director Michael Hayden went into a panic, and he told CNN, "We would never track Americans as was depicted in the film. We've learned our lessons." Remind us about that lesson when in 1975, a Senate committee led by Senator Frank Church of Idaho revealed that the NSA had intercepted phone calls of other Americans.
Well, I don't think I can tell you too specifically, just because it's such a long time ago. At that time, as part of the Church Committee hearings of wrongdoings, primarily by the Nixon administration, the mystery group in the background was the National Security Agency, and I was asked to testify after Attorney General Leahy, who defended the National Security Agency monitoring of communications, and I was asked to testify about on the other side.
Well, what we do know about the Church Pike hearings is that they laid the groundwork for the 1978 FISA law, which ruled that no eavesdropping on American soil could take place without a warrant. And I guess, do you see a parallel between today's hearings and those hearings?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a parallel. The fear was that the very great capacities of the National Security Agency, if turned loose on Americans, could produce a substantial reduction in our privacy, or at least a fear of that that would chill political speech and even intimate speech. That led to not only the FISA statute that you referred to, but also a set of regulations by the National Security Agency, which were very protective of Americans. What's interesting in that regard, and in light of the film and General Hayden's response, is the National Security Agency really has a tradition of being extremely careful to stay away from Americans, more careful than they ever had to be by law. And it was a very deep tradition, which suddenly got changed by the administration with this program.
Right, and you mentioned the film. I think I misspoke. I think I said The Enemy of the People, the 1999 film. It was, of course, The Enemy of the State,
yeah.
Although some people, you know, could understand that mix-up. Now, we understand, Phil Hyman, that last month you, along with former FBI Director William Sessions, wrote a letter to the congressional leaders saying that this current wiretapping program appears on its face to violate existing law. We hear Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez once again today defend the program, saying again that congressional authorization of war justifies it. Can you briefly explain why scholars such as yourself don't accept that?
Well, letter was not written by former FBI Director Sessions and me, but we both signed it. It was written by a very, very distinguished group of constitutional law professors from around the country, extremely distinguished. They said that the authorization to use force did not, and I, who signed onto it, and Sessions, who signed onto it, did not authorize bypassing FISA because the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is very explicit about it, except its exceptions. It allows the president 15 days after war starts to tap anybody he wants. That certainly was not used here. And it allows the Attorney General to go ahead and wiretap without first going to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court if an emergency comes up, and only go within 72 hours. That was never used here. The very specific exceptions are inconsistent with some kind of notion that authorizing the use of force against al-Qaeda allowed the president to just bypass this statute. It would also come as a complete surprise to the members of Congress, and I think did, that was claimed. And the final point is that if the authorization of the use of force allowed the president just to ignore a very specific, clear statute with its own exceptions, FISA, it allows him to ignore almost any statute at all.
Well, in fact, we understand that conservatives normally supportive of the president are split on this. For instance, the gun lobby saying, you know, what if it's not a president friendly to us, then this same thinking can be used to eavesdrop on us. So it's not as if everyone is in agreement on this.
Yeah, and it isn't even just eavesdropping. The argument from the authorization use of force is that it authorized anything the president thought would help in fighting terrorism, and that would allow him in his own discretion, no matter how great the help or how little the help, to overrule any statute.
Well, Professor Hyman, in about the minute we have, just a very brief comment. Do you have sympathy with this administration in that even at the time of Enemy of the State, the film we spoke of, the NSA was wrestling, and this is in 2000, with a huge bulk of information? There's the Internet, there's BlackBerries, there's all these sophisticated technologies, and they didn't feel they had the time to go through it and get to a court. Just in a few seconds we have.
Well, adding dots doesn't make it easier to connect the dots. I do think it was well worth thinking about whether there should be any changes in FISA to give them more power to protect
them. Change the law first and go through Congress.
The law. Don't do it secretly. Don't do it on your own.
Phil Hyman, professor at Harvard Law School. He was the former deputy attorney general during the Clinton administration, a former prosecutor during Watergate. Phil, thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
And next, the conservatives who did try to stop the Bush administration's secret program and soon lost their jobs. Much more coming up here and now. And tried to stop it, a story that's told in a recent article in Newsweek magazine. The story is entitled Palace Revolt, and it tells of loyal conservatives in the Justice Department who either resigned or were forced to leave because they refused to authorize the wiretapping program and other secret proposals. Daniel Kleidman is one of Newsweek's reporters. He joins us on the phone. And Daniel, tell us about these men. Where do they fit into the story?
In some ways, the most important figure is a man named Jack Goldsmith, who headed up a very powerful, obscure but very powerful office in the Justice Department called the Office of Legal Counsel. And Goldsmith, when he arrived in that position in October of 2003, began rolling back legal opinions that had been written by his predecessors that were quite far-reaching. And we believe that one of them was legal opinion authorizing the NSA program. Now, in that particular case, Goldsmith did not say that it was illegal to do this wiretapping in principle, but the way it was being done was unconstitutional.
And then there's a character who fought these four rebels, as you call them, sometimes ferociously. That's David Addington. He's the man who replaced Scooter Libby as Vice President Dick Cheney's chief of staff, a ferocious defender of the administration's policies.
That's right. He is in some ways the personification of the almost radical views that this administration has espoused on presidential powers, that the president during wartime has essentially unfettered powers and unreviewable powers in the conduct of national security. And Addington is someone who was willing to go after his opponents, sometimes in ways that some people believe crossed the line.
Now, these conservative rebels who opposed David Addington and that thinking at the time, you write they weren't really whistleblowers in the traditional sense.
That's right, and I think in some ways that's the most one of the most interesting aspects of this story. These, as we've said, were faithful conservatives, Bush appointees, believers in the Bush administration's war on terror, but they thought that in some cases the administration was pushing the boundaries of the law, and ultimately they were more faithful to the law than they were to their their own personal politics. But in some ways, it's the fact that they weren't traditional whistleblowers, that they weren't on some sort of a moral crusade and hoping to get on the cover of a magazine or interviewed on television. Yeah, that's precisely what made these decisions so difficult for them, because they wanted to be loyal, they wanted to continue to be faithful to the administration's policies, but they ultimately they had a sort of a crisis of conscience and believed that they couldn't.
Well, some of these rebels fought the torture memo, giving the president near total authority over detainees. But we want to talk again specifically about the wiretapping, which they also fought. This was something Addington and others in the Bush administration had been pushing for since 9/11. How did someone like Jack Goldsmith fight Addington?
Well, in the way that lawyers do, which is to make very complicated but important legal arguments. In the case of Goldsmith, he came into the Office of Legal Counsel and he began reviewing his predecessor's work. And some of the arguments that were made before he got there, I think he believed were not well-reasoned and were not well-found in the Constitution.
Well, and then there was James Comey, who was Deputy Attorney General under John Ashcroft. And there's an interesting, you couldn't make this up in a fiction account of this. There was an interesting element in that John Ashcroft was sick at the time in the hospital. And it was James Comey, the number two, who made a decision not to authorize the program, which infuriated the president.
Right. The dramatic climax of this battle was in March of 2004, when they needed recertification. John Ashcroft was in the hospital suffering from a rare pancreatic condition, and so they went to the man who was acting as Attorney General, James Comey. Well, Comey said no. He had been hearing from Goldsmith and others about the legal problems that they had been raising, and he said no to the White House. Well, the White House decided that they would go straight to the Attorney General.
At his bedside,
this dramatic scene where then White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez and White House Chief of Staff Andy Card actually go to the hospital in Washington, go to his bedside, and ask John Ashcroft for his approval, his blessing. And probably to their surprise, he said no. He backed up Comey. Why exactly he did that? Was it loyalty to his deputy? Was it because he had legal problems with the program? Is still a mystery, but it's a fascinating aspect of the story. What happens then is elements of the program were essentially shut down for a period of months while this is being sorted out. And ultimately, there was some kind of a compromise, and it got up and running again, we believe, in about July of 2004.
Well, things were sorted out, but also the rebels, many of them left. We know that Jack Goldsmith ended up at Harvard. There's a huge irony there that you point out, that he had sort of a frosty reception at what's seen as a traditionally liberal school and a liberal town. These intellectuals, not knowing that he had fought so hard against some of these administration plans.
That's right. It is an irony. And of course, the reason that Harvard and the faculty there did not know what his role was because so much of what he was doing was classified. He simply couldn't talk about it. He was subjected to this criticism when he arrived. There was a front-page article in the Boston Globe talking about his involvement in these controversial memos, and some of the more liberal members of the faculty were suggesting that he, you know, was some kind of a war criminal. Throughout it all, Goldsmith couldn't say anything. Fortunately, the real story has seen the light of day, and perhaps he's getting a nicer reception on campus.
Well, given what you've pieced together here, what do you think can be said about the Bush administration, which at one point was thought to be in lockstep?
Actually, some people in the administration have suggested to me, well, this is a sign that there actually is dissent in this administration, that that you can speak out and have an effect on policy. Well, on the other hand, these people had to fight extremely hard. They paid a price, and in some cases, people were, you know, essentially driven out of government or certainly blocked from getting promotions. And the question is, should you have to pay that high a price to really try to affect the debate and affect policy?
Daniel Kleidman, reporter for Newsweek magazine and one of the authors of the article Palace Revolt, telling the story of four loyal conservatives who served in the Justice Department and stood up to hardliners in the Bush administration, refusing to authorize the wiretapping program that's being examined today in a hearing in the Senate. Daniel, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. REMAX of New England, a source for real estate assistance in New England.
I gotta have them signed to the label.
Diet Pepsi's commercial starring rapper P. Diddy, actor Jay Moore, and a can was one of the most highly anticipated ads during the Super Bowl last night, where we should mention the Pittsburgh Steelers trounced the Seattle Seahawks 21-10. Every American knows the drill. The Super Bowl is as important to Madison Avenue ad execs as the Oscars are to Hollywood movie studios, and it may also be the only time of the year that people actually watch commercials. Pop culture guru and Syracuse University professor Bob Thompson joins us now. He says this year's crop of Super Bowl ads reflect a change in the advertising world. Professor, how so?
Well, I think Madison Avenue has figured out a couple of things. Number one, they had all that trouble after the 2004 Super Bowl, so these things were kinder, gentler, a little less sexual, a little less scatological. Secondly, they've also figured out that there's a lot more people in that 90 million plus that are not necessarily football fans and that are not necessarily men. And this tended to skew much more to family-friendly, even though they were advertising beer, and to women as well.
Well, I'm thinking of the Dove ad that talked about young girls having, you know, a hard time with their body image.
Show me a smile then. Don't be unhappy, can't remember.
Who would have ever expected that Super Bowl would pay to, you know, would have a commercial in it essentially aimed at, you know, at pre-adolescent and early adolescent women?
Well, Bob, each 30-second ad costs about $2.5 million to air during the Super Bowl. A lot goes into this. The P. Diddy one that we listened to was, I'm sure, costly. They didn't have to pay the can, but they paid him. That one sort of fell through for me. It didn't really work. How would you rate overall the whole slate of Super Bowl ads?
Well, I think you're right about those Pepsi ads. They just kind of sat there. There's really four kinds of ads. There's the really good ones that also sell product. And I would say the Budweiser Baby Clydesdale was that. And so were the cavemen for FedEx.
Well, hold on a second. The Baby Clydesdale was the one where the little Clydesdale had to try to pull the wagon by himself. And there was a big Clydesdale behind the wagon.
Right. Mom and Dad were helping unbeknownst to baby, which is, you know, spoke volumes about all kinds of things. The reason that was a good commercial is it was touching, saccharine, but very nice. And at the same time, you will never forget that was a Budweiser commercial. There were Clydesdales.
Right.
Now, a cute little family-friendly commercial for beer is a whole other story. The other one was FedEx, which we also wouldn't forget, and that had about 17 good jokes in it, and it was attached to its product.
And the FedEx one was about cavemen, a guy who made a mistake sending something by, I don't know, Trontosaurus or something. Thank you. Rather than FedEx, and of course, he gets stomped by a bigger dinosaur.
Next time, use FedEx.
Now, I'm hearing that people thought that was hilarious. Did you think that was hilarious?
Well, I did, only because it would not stop. It's a short little commercial, and the lines kept coming and coming. First, the guy trying to send something by pterodactyl was pretty amusing. Then the pterodactyl gets eaten by a bigger beast in a really kind of gruesome but kind of cool little thing. And then the boss, you know, why didn't you use FedEx? But, sir, FedEx hasn't been invented yet. Not my problem.
Now, you mentioned beer commercials. There were many. A favorite in our office is the Magic Fridge, where a guy's installed this revolving refrigerator that hides behind the wall so that his friends don't drink his beer, unbeknownst to him. It goes into the neighboring apartment, where there's a bunch of 20-somethings who are worshiping this magic refrigerator that appears suddenly. Let's listen.
Guys, hurry up! The Magic Fridge is back!
That was very funny.
Yeah, and believe it or not, it even works on radio. And one of the reasons that does work is you've got these highbrow smart guys who have come up with this fancy technology, and on the other side of the wall are these idiots who behave like the apes on 2001. They're worshiping this thing that appears. They're bowing to it by the end. Classic Super Bowl commercial, very old school.
Take off some of the other images, if you could, just laundry list that come to mind that you remember from last night.
Well, there was I have to say the most effective commercials are the ones that were no fun whatsoever, and that was the ABC promos. Nobody is remembering the Grey's Anatomy episode promotions. They weren't funny, they weren't interesting, they weren't anything. However, they did make you want to watch Grey's Anatomy.
Wait a minute, there was one ad where, was it Shaquille O'Neal? Sinks a basket and then turns to the camera and he's crying and he over a character in Desperate Housewives who lost her baby.
Right. Well, watching macho sports guys get in touch with their inner Desperate Housewife was really funny. And then the best one was Robert Palmer doing Addicted to Lost, which really worked. So I think there you've got commercials which nobody really does remembers that much, but they're going to move product off the shelf. I think those really did promote those shows. And sometimes I think Madison Avenue forgets that in all the frenzy to make this a mini film festival, they forget what the whole point of an ad is, which is to sell stuff.
I like the sheared sheep who was a streaker at some sort of a Rocky Mountain High touch football game.
Oh, yeah.
The guy with the cell phone who said it was a crime to turn, and to prove it, he threw it at his friend's head.
And then my favorite, and I am ashamed to admit this to you, but chimpanzees in clothes, that's funny enough. But I have never seen anything funnier than what pants look like on a donkey. Very disturbing, but very funny.
Syracuse University Professor Bob Thompson, I want to ask you about one ad that caught our eye before we let you go. It's the Toyota hybrid ad. There's an Hispanic father and son talking about the importance of the future. The boy asks his dad, why are we driving a hybrid? And he explains it's for your future. And then the boy asks his dad why he learned English as a second language.
Why did you learn English?
For your future.
Bob Thompson, what was the message there?
Well, you know, it was a good idea. That was one of the most anticipated ads. Journalists have been writing about that for weeks before the Super Bowl, and it sounded like a good idea, and it sounds like a nice, bilingual commercial and all the rest of it. It didn't really seem to work. I think part of it was that it seemed a little bit preachy. The guy seemed to be delivering the lines, off of cue cards. And while that connection between, okay, a hybrid, I want to, assure your future by behaving so the environment will be safe, just like I want to assure your future by making sure you're armed with both languages to go out and do battle in the world, all of that made sense when you thought about it. But for some reason, that commercial just kind of, laid an egg. One other thing I think we might point out, which is that not only did Madison Avenue pull off this incredible sleight of hand about 20 years ago, that we're all watching the commercials like we would a program, but the other sleight of hand is they're not that good. And I wonder at what point people are going to say, yeah, they were pretty funny, and yes, I was half in the bag when, a velvet Elvis would have looked like the Mona Lisa. But in the end, maybe it's time to start going to the bathroom during the commercials again.
Pop culture guru and Syracuse University professor Bob Thompson. Bob, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you. You know I'm with it, so come and get it.
I don't know, that revolving refrigerator was pretty funny. Well, as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on our program, Super Bowl ads probably being the least important thing. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Still to come, could any of these Super Bowl ads be considered art? We'll talk with a critic who says art is anything you say it is. You're listening to Here and Now. Tomorrow, Haiti holds its first election since President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was ousted 2 years ago. Since then, kidnappings, murders on the street, violence, and general chaos are the norm. Some Haitians living in the U.S. say they have mixed expectations about the elections. Producer Rachel Gottbaum visited the Privilege Restaurant in Boston's Mattapan neighborhood.
My name is Jean-Claude Senon. I'm also a Haitian radio host within the Haitian community.
Are you optimistic for these elections that are coming on Tuesday? There's many, many people running.
About 32, and not counting the one that just passed away. Optimistic has always been my key focus in life. I would assume anything would be much better than what we have right now.
What do you have right now?
Well, Haiti has right now a bunch of guys who's fighting for power, and everybody wants to eat a piece of the pie by themselves and not really wanting to partake it with everybody else. And hopefully there'll be a leader that will arise out of them or teach them to distribute the wealth of this country among its people so they can learn how to live with each other.
Why do you think that there's so much chaos there now?
I'll be honest with you. Why I think there's enough chaos, number one, we haven't yet recognized the enemy is in our midst. The enemy is in our midst, meaning that we are the only solutions. We are the only hope to ever solve our problems. As long as we keep relying upon other people to do it for us, it will never be accomplished. Never mind the international community, I think we can just forget about them.
Okay. I guess we have some tea coming up here. Thank you very much.
Hello.
Hello. Can you just tell me your name, sir?
My name is Oswald Neptune. Mm-hmm. I've been here in this country for about 20 years. I cannot wait to go back there and to serve my people, my country. But unfortunately, I have to stay here for how long, I don't know.
What have you found about the community here in terms of where they stand over the elections?
It seems that for quite some time, the Haitian community is kind of divided when it's come to politics.
What about this table here, these gentlemen here?
You are so fortunate that you can have different opinion in here around this table, but sometimes two friends don't want to sit down to talk about politics because if you are for Aristide and the other one is for another candidate, we don't get along. It's a mess out there.
Why is it such a mess?
We say that we are patriot. We are nationalists, but it seems that we care only for ourselves, our own interests. We cannot develop a plan for the country, a common plan for the country. You are lucky to see Abner and myself here around this table. Most of the time, I don't want to work with him to save the country. That's our problem.
So Abner, I guess we've been talking a little bit about you. So are you hopeful with these elections?
In the history of Haiti, in our 200 years, we've had about 30 or 34 coup d'etat. And the problem with Haiti is that we need to be better educated. We need to learn to sit down and talk to each other. We need to be able to negotiate. We need to understand, like President Bush was saying, that a good debate is healthy.
Is there hope here with this election, or is it just going to be business as usual?
That's the only thing that is left to the Haitians. They have taken everything else. All we have is hope. If we've been denying this hope, we're dead.
Do you want to be interviewed?
Okay.
Well, what's your name?
In my office, Jean-Michel Saint-Jean.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to just talk a little bit about the elections?
I would like to see an election with candidates who have the opportunity to run their campaign being protected, and our voters know that they are going to the booth and they know that they are going back home.
So how could the United States help that happen?
By postponing the election. Put in place a presidential council.
A presidential council.
Well, yes. So that we can be ready for a fair election in Haiti.
Well, thank you very much. Enjoy your dinner. You got a lot. What'd you get? Are you going to tell me?
Caviar.
You got caviar. Okay, thank you.
Producer Rachel Gottbaum with a view of tomorrow's elections in Haiti from the Privilege Restaurant in Mattapan, Massachusetts. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. The Big Mama's House, too. If you've ever walked out of an art museum or movie that absolutely everybody is talking about and said, huh? We've got an argument for you. In his controversial new book, What Good Are the Arts?, John Carey, a chief critic for the Sunday Times of London, argues that the benefits of the fine arts have been overinflated for centuries. Who would think that a critic would emerge from his rarefied air and say that the arts can make no claims for superiority to science or religion, and that there are no absolute standards of judgment? He argues that video games and TV shows are works of art if someone believes they are. Here and now, arts critic Bill Marks spoke with John Carey.
Well, let me first start by asking you not the question that of the title of the book, which is what good are the arts, but starting from another direction, what harm do the arts do?
I think they can do different kinds of harm, but one kind of harm they can do is to make people feel inferior. I think the notion of what is great in art, what it's right to admire, is so powerful that a lot of people come to art when they're young, when they're teenagers, and feel either intimidated and feel they must submit to these standards, and they know they don't really like these things, or they feel that they don't want that at all and rebel and go to some different kind of art. And so they can, I think, do that sort of harm in that they split people up into those who are, quote, cultured and admirable for their taste and those who feel they're not.
Isn't that also true of any perhaps misapplication or manipulation of people who assert standards? For example, scientists looking down on non-scientists.
Science is a matter of proof, the repeatability of experiments, facts that can be established in a scientific way. It seems to me that art is not like that. Whether something is a work of art is more, to my mind, like whether something is funny. And you can say, well, it's wrong to laugh at, I don't know, religion or death or whatever. However, people do laugh at it. And the idea of making a law, you know, what is funny and what is not, is ludicrous. People would laugh at that. So what is funny is it's got all the infinity of human difference written into it. That is not like science.
Particularly with the arts, though, I mean, that's part of what makes the arts, maybe not the word is funny, but fun, to the extent that there's a continual dialogue and exchange of, you know, which artists are better or considered better than other artists. And, of course, these things change over the years. So artists who have lasted for 100 years are considered, let's say, better than artists who perhaps were acclaimed at the time that they first debuted their works or wrote their books, but now are forgotten.
Oh, I've no quarrel at all with that. I entirely agree. I mean, what my book is saying is that art is, yeah, infinite, that what you consider is art for you. Stockhausen, the composer, has said recently, apparently, that 9/11, that the destruction of the Twin Towers, was a stupendous work of art. Well, that seems to me an obscene thing to say. But I can see that it's ludicrous for me to say, well, he's wrong, it's not a work of art for him. It's a work of art for him, I hope only for him, not for me. So that's why I say in the book that a work of art is anything anyone has ever thought a work of art, though it may be a work of art just for that one person. It is infinite.
I mean, that's an interesting idea, though certainly the limitlessness of it is a little frightening. When you talk about, for example, what the arts are good for, you talk about classes in prisons and in schools. Well, then what do we teach? I mean, who makes those judgments if, for example, instead of teaching Shakespeare, someone decides, well, I like video games, so I think that prisoners should be working at creating video games?
Yeah, I think that's a very pertinent objection. And I would say that you look at what has given instruction, pleasure, joy and so on, spiritual uplift. You look at what has given that to most people over the centuries. That's why it seems to me to have a English department, say, which didn't have Shakespeare in the curriculum would be ludicrous, because Shakespeare has been liked and admired and read by all the other writers. They keep referring to him. So if you don't know about Shakespeare, you don't know about literature. So I've no quarrel with the canon as an instrument in teaching. It just seems to be sensible, yeah, to teach things that have given mankind pleasure. All I'm saying is that that does not seem to me to amount to an absolute standard. I don't believe in absolute eternal standards. I don't believe that there are some kinds of art that God likes, as it were, and some that he doesn't. Though this was commonly said in the 19th century, it was said by John Ruskin, I quote him in the book, that there's a divine sanction to some kinds of art. That's where it seems to me to get dangerous, because then people who don't like it are somehow fatally wrong. I mean, I was walking around the about MoMA on Saturday, as a matter of fact, and it came to me to feel, well, I think I must be right about what I said, because I mean, where do you draw the line? Every kind of experience is entering art. Well, I actually find that great. I find that fine. I would much rather have that, and it seems to me to lead to the sense that art is infinite, whereas science is not. Science could theoretically come to an end, supposing you did find out everything about the physical universe. That would, I suppose, you know, be the end of science. But with art, it's just as infinite as the human imagination, so there's no end to it.
Now, I obviously, in this book, you're not saying don't, you know, partake of the arts. I'm sort of asking what is, you know, besides raising a bit of a ruckus, you know, what was the impulse behind writing this book?
Yeah, well, one change I would like to see is that I would like to see critics, and I read critics a lot in the newspapers and in books, and I would like to see critics using the word I and not the word we. I'd like to see critics realizing that what they say is just for them. Maybe other people will agree, maybe they won't. But when they try and lay down what seemed to them to be firm and absolute standards, that's when it seems to me to get meaningless and very annoying. So I would like critics to make it clear that they're speaking for themselves, their own opinions, and how they react. That's valuable, I think, because if you see how they react, if they let you feel how they feel, then maybe you will start to get pleasure too. Maybe not. Doesn't matter if you don't. But if you, that's the way, I think, that great critics work. A critic I very much admire is Christopher Ricks. He's at Boston University. He can describe what it's like for him to read a line of poetry as no other critic, to me, can do it. And he will see things you haven't seen, and it changes, you know, it changes the way that you react. And he's not saying it's good or bad. He's saying, this is how I see it, this is how I feel. It's a very remarkable feat of articulacy, very difficult. You know, you ask yourself, why do I like this? And it's strange, because when I look at a work of art or listen to a piece of music, even read a piece of literature, I find that my reaction, like or dislike, is pretty well instantaneous, actually. When you start to think why, I find it's almost fathomless. You go back into yourself, into your cultural history and your personality. And this is indeed what psychologists say. They say that to understand the reasons behind artistic taste would need infinite knowledge about that person's life history, about his education and so on, and about his nature, his genes, and yeah, it's absolutely fathomless. And there's no right or wrong in this, it's just explaining how different people are.
John Carey, thank you so much for talking to me about your book, What Good Are the Arts?
Thank you very much.
Here now, arts critic Bill Mark spoke with Sunday Times chief literary critic John Carey. Again, the name of his book is What Good Are the Arts? Here now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll check in on elections in Haiti. Also, reggae fans are